This week, an encounter that has become vanishingly rare. On Unholy, a dialogue between a leading Israeli analyst and a leading Palestinian activist on what happens next in this war, what comes the day after. It's Unholy. I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London.
And I'm Yonit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv. Unholy, two Jews on the news. Before we get to the bigger questions about Rafah, this week saw, I think, a return of what Israel wants to be, in a daring and cunning and successful operation. Two hostages were rescued alive and well. Luis Har and Fernando Merman, they were rescued in an operation the police commissioner called an Entebbe-style operation, Israeli Special Forces, a dramatic overnight raid. And, you know, one of those moments where you see the pictures, you hear the news. I think the most emotional moments before them meeting their family is, of course, that story about the fact that the soldiers were hugging and protecting them as the fire broke out. And again, this is Israel as we want to be, right? Soldiers going in, protecting them with their bodies, bringing them back home alive.
Yeah, and the invocation of Entebbe, hugely evocative and loaded. And of course, with Entebbe comes the associations of, as you said, of Israel as we want it to be, and as how the world then looked at Israel as this heroic, plucky David against Goliath nation, engaged in, you know, almost impossible courage and ingenuity. Then the sort of dissenting note that shows how things have changed since then is I really did notice in the coverage outside Israel, a change even within the few months of this war, because when hostages had been freed through military operations before, there was some of that admiration in the coverage. This time, very quickly, attention went on reports that there had been a decoy operation in order to divert Hamas's attention by the IDF, and that decoy operation had involved some 60-odd Palestinian deaths to enable the release of those two hostages. And I just thought, okay, that's interesting how central that was in a lot of the coverage. It suggested to me it went with the grain of a sort of decreasing patience on the part of the world, where earlier hostage rescues were given the Entebbe treatment, if you like, a couple of months ago. Now they were given this very sort of caveated admiration. Well, yes, good that you've done that, but look at the enormous cost, proportionally in human life.
So we should say, by the way, that the official Israeli response to that was that the numbers were largely exaggerated of the Palestinian death. I will go back to just basking on the mission for one more minute and say, or remind our listeners that Clara Merman and her sister Gabriela and her sister's daughter Mia were also abducted. They were released. Mia is the girl that was photographed all over the world with her dog Bella. She also had her while in captivity. So Fernando is Clara's brother. Luis is her partner. And again, those moments where they hug their family, everyone is back together. Also a moment to remind us that there are still 134 hostages held by Hamas. 32 of them are dead. This is not guesswork. This is Israeli intelligence and pathologists verifying this information, but the time is running out for the rest of these hostages. And although the prime minister keeps saying, you know, this is the way to release them, more pressure, more raids, we know that that is a complicated question within Israel as well.
Yeah. And the other thing I thought sort of emotionally looking at them were these were two men. And in all of the previous rounds of sort of negotiation, they were at the back of the queue in terms of releases. Mm-hmm. The conversation had been about, absolutely rightly, about children, about women, about the sick, about the very elderly. These two were not going to be released in a way any other way. And it was going to take a rescue effort by them, absent an overall, all-encompassing deal that gets everyone out. These are people whose only hope was going to be a rescue. But, you know, we covered at the time those rescue efforts where those men or failed or abortive or in thwarted rescue efforts that ended so tragically. Those three men who somehow amazingly got themselves out, again, men, and were waving the sign. They'd written the sign SOS, etc., and then killed in a so-called friendly fire episode, and how horribly that ended, tragically that ended, you realize that the chances of a successful rescue are so narrow. It's so hard to pull this off. And those men were unlikely to be reunited with their families any other way.
Yes, and again, this brings to the foreground, not that it ever left the foreground, the issue of a bigger hostage deal. Netanyahu very adamant in saying, we will fighting until victory, we will put military pressure on Hamas, we're in Khan Yunus now, we will continue an intent to invade Rafah. The problem with that is the fact that the situation of the hostages is clearly becoming dire. Right now, this week, Netanyahu asked the delegation, the Israeli delegation in Cairo, just to sit in the room and listen, not to suggest anything, meaning that their leeway was quite narrow. And also important to say that all of these decisions made by Netanyahu were made by him alone. He did not discuss this with his war cabinet, importantly, not with Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and not with his two important participants in this war cabinet, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot. So this is where we are. The families are furious. They say that Netanyahu is really biding his time here and not acting in the hurried way that he should be. He is saying that he is a tough negotiator and that's the only way. Also, we should remind our listeners that the answer Hamas gave to the initial framework of a deal is a complete non-starter, not only in the eyes of Israelis, but in the eyes of the United States as well.
You know, we talked, I think even just last week, about this dilemma that Israel faces, about on the one hand, it needs to fight a war that defeats Hamas, who after all stage this murderous assault on October 7th, an enemy that can't be allowed to remain just over the fence there in Gaza. And on the other hand, the need to bring home the hostages. And we talked about it as this predicament, as if it's an ongoing dilemma. In some ways, it strikes me, again, hearing you sketch out the situation then, this isn't a sort of ongoing dilemma. In a way, Netanyahu is telling us he's made his judgment. He's made his judgment call. And that is, these are twin goals. But the release and rescue of the hostages, or the bringing home of the hostages through negotiation, is secondary of those two twins. And that the war and the military operation is his priority. In other words, I think just how I've been framing it in my mind is sort of on the one hand, on the other, as if he's wrestling with it. I think he's telling us he's made his call. The more important thing is the war. Hostages come second. Hard to say, hard to take, but that's his judgment. And I think, you know, you could imagine there would be people who would defend that in its own terms. The problem is that you don't feel he's weighed that up on the kind of moral scales. Instead, he's thought, of the two, which is the one that prolongs this government longer? And that is the war going on. If there's a hostage deal, that brings forward the day of elections and his exit from power. And so I think he's made his call, but I don't think he's made it for reasons that that many people would want to defend.
You know, what makes Israel so complicated is the fact that there's always a kernel of truth beyond the politics. And the kernel of truth is that Hamas needs to be militarily defeated. There are people who would say more clearly what you're saying. They live in Channel 14, which is considered by many Israelis the mouthpiece of Netanyahu. And they will say, yes, the war and specifically winning Hamas is more important. And they will say that out loud. Netanyahu doesn't say it like that, obviously. There are many others in Israel who say, you can pause, you can press pause on this war to take out the hostages. They don't have time. So this is an ongoing debate. It is so ferociously become a debate in this country. We've talked about how this has been politicized, that there are actual people who online are attacking hostages' families, right? And saying things about them that you would never imagine, that these people who have been through hell and are still living hell, they don't know where their loved ones are, if they're alive or not, how their living conditions are, and they are being attacked by some people who say, you are hindering the war efforts, and you're hindering also a hostage deal effort because you're raising the price too high. I mean, this is the discussion happening. It's unbelievable that it is happening, but that is what we're seeing.
I think people will find it very shocking to hear what you said there. I think people would assume that the hostage families are treated reverentially with great respect. And it was actually when I was in the country a few weeks back that there was a committee of the Knesset gathering that was attended by hostage families. And the families were being abused and shouted at by members of one of the ultra-nationalist parties. And I found that so shocking because I thought people would tiptoe around these families almost in the way we tiptoe around Holocaust survivors or something. I found it extremely jolting and jarring. And the thing I do wonder about a bit is whether that is simply because it's now a vehement argument about the merits and rights and wrongs of continuing the fight against Hamas or pausing it, or whether it is infused in a way with a kind of culture war dimension, because, to put it, you know, harshly, those taken hostage were, in the eyes of the ultra-nationalist right, the wrong kind of Israeli. That they were secular, they were often voters on the left, they were perhaps in the peace camp, they were from the kibbutz. And therefore, on some level, some of these ultra-nationalists care less about them than they would if they were, for example, religious, ultra-Orthodox or Orthodox, or they were from the nationalist camp, they were settlers in the West Bank. I'm not so sure that the people shouting at them now on Channel 14 would be quite so blasé about bringing home their families if they were from their side of the cultural divide in Israel. That's just a thought that rather bleakly strikes me.
I think it's definitely a tragedy that this whole issue has become politicized. I don't think it's a coincidence. Usually when things become weaponized in this way, there are people who have a vested interest in them becoming politicized. But it's definitely now, it looks like the people who say war and eliminating Hamas first would call themselves from the right camp. And the people who say press pause and bring back the hostages because that is what we must do, then go back to the war. People like Eisenkot are in the more center left part of Israeli society. But again, we all can agree on one thing, which is time is running out.
And patience is running out internationally. Absolute stepping up of that sentiment and how open world leaders are. I mean, those people who are against the war will be furious that the expressions are, they would say, still pretty mild. But in diplomatic jargon and language, there has definitely been a ratcheting up of the pressure from many of Israel's allies, but obviously most centrally the United States. Joe Biden describing Israel's operations against Hamas as over the top, and then being reported as saying, privately expressing his dim view of Prime Minister Netanyahu, referring to him.
Don't say the word. No,
don't worry.
My parents are listening to this podcast.
I was going to say, are we allowed to say a-hole? Does that do it? Is that the equivalent?
I said my parents are listening to the podcast. What don't you understand?
Okay, I'm so sorry. I was going to anyway cite the conversation that was caught on an open mic between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney when they referred to somebody as a major league, and you can insert the word there. The degree of frustration that Washington is feeling about the way Netanyahu is, in a way, just shaking off, dismissing the calls for restraint that have now come for months from Tony Blinken and from Joe Biden. And it is, in some ways, a bit humiliating for the Biden administration that they keep making these gestures and signals and pleas, and Israel is basically ignoring them. And it's given the pressure that there is now on Joe Biden domestically, within his own party, within the American electorate, to act and to bring this war basically to an end, is what the younger progressive wing of the Democratic Party want from him. His own patience is sorely being tested.
Yes. We have to see, I mean, besides the wording, is there a dramatic change in policy? We did see the sanctions against four extreme settlers. We do need to see where that is going. But in the general sense, is there a shift in policy besides what is being said behind closed doors? It's also important to note that the Washington Post reported that the United States, several Arab countries, want to present a long-term peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians. We'll discuss this further in our conversation. By the way, Netanyahu himself, while asked this week by ABC about Biden's mental state, said that he is very clear and very focused. We should also say something, if we may, about the tumultuous, one more thing about tumultuous Israel this week. On the table in the Knesset is a bill that extends military service for conscripts, for soldiers, and for reservists. The war obviously being the backdrop of all this, but the fact that this is a government that also wants to exempt ultra-Orthodox officially from military service is quite a friction in the country, so much so that the head of the military, the chief of staff of the IDF, Herzi Halevi, came out this week and said, we have an historic opportunity to expand IDF recruitment sources. Everyone should do their part to protect our home. That is very irregular that a chief of staff would say something that is in an issue that is so politically charged. But that will be, when we talk about the day after in this episode, and we will talk a lot about Gaza and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, this will be an internal conflict within Israel that will, I don't want to say blow up, but definitely become very charged in the days after the war.
Yeah, and you know, remember a conversation that predated October 7th was particularly around the time of the protests against the so-called judicial coup, was how much longer would Israel's hyper-educated, very talented, often secular, younger people carry this burden where they're paying a disproportionate volume of Israel's taxation and then also required to give up either their own, you know, best years, their youth, or the time of their, you know, children, their early 20s and later years. The burden falls disproportionately on one segment of Israeli society, and people were already worried about whether at some point those people would make a calculation and say, you know what, I could live a better life in San Francisco. It's putting yet more and more strain on that particular demographic. And it's not necessarily one for right now when the country's at war, but those are big questions that have been opened up.
Now, this week, we wanted to do something different, to bring together an Israeli and a Palestinian to talk about the day after. And we've got two people ideally placed for this exact kind of rather unique conversation.
Sameh Sinjilawi is from East Jerusalem. He chairs the Jerusalem Development Fund. He's a political activist aligned with Fatah, though a strong critic of the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. And he's also a widely published commentator and, we discover, the father of 8 children. So we may occasionally hear the voices of the next generation too. Dr. Michael Milstein is from Kiryat Ono. He's the head of the Palestinian Studies Forum at the Moshe Dayan Center. Previously, he served as the advisor on Palestinian affairs for COGAT, the Coordinator of Government Activities in the Territories. And he's considered one of Israel's foremost experts on Hamas and the wider Palestinian arena. Sameh, Michael, really good to have you both on Unholy. As an opening question, we've obviously brought you together, but you are in contact with each other anyway. How do you know each other?
If I remember correct, Sameh, it was about 2 years. I think it was in 2021 or 2022 when you wrote me that you read some of my articles and you want us to meet, and we met, and since then we're friends. We are in close contact. I learn a lot of things from Sameh, his insights and the things that he brings, not only insights, but also, messages about the relations between Jews and Arabs here in Israel. I consider them a lot. And I'm very lucky that Sameh opened this channel between us.
Well, I have a hobby. I would like to meet any Israeli who accepts to meet me. So I read a lot the Israeli media. That's why I watch Yonit almost every night, every evening. And whenever I see something impressive, whenever I see that an Israeli really understands Palestinians in a significant way, I try to reach to him and to try to, you know, discuss more and see how we can develop a lot of mutual understanding. And that's how we met. And I really think Michael is an Israeli that knows a lot about Palestinians. And this is not common these days. For me, Israelis and Palestinians are not enemies to each other. They have a common enemy, which is ignorance. We need to overcome this. And this can be overcome if we try to create a lot of bridges and channels of dialogue, and we need both sides. So reaching the other side is really something very important. Trying, especially in these very sad and difficult days, the Israelis I knew before the 7th of October are not the Israelis I have now after the 7th of October, and the same is for Palestinians. We both have a cocktail of feelings, sadness, anger, hatred, I can say, revenge. It's there. It's still controlling us. this is not whom we are, but this is what the 7th of October pushed us to. And these days, even we need more to work on opening channels, to try to understand the grief of the other side and to try to understand the new challenges that we have now. And we need to find a way out of this madness. Whatever happens in the war in Gaza, the Israelis and Palestinians will continue to live in this land. Nothing will change. And we will still face one challenge. What should be done? How can we change this tragedy that has shocked everybody and push it into a direction that instead of distancing us from a potential of breakthrough and development in our relation, we need to see if it can bring us closer. And I think it's possible. The challenge here is lack of leadership on both sides. I don't see a lot of wisdom on the leadership from both sides. And in a way or another, we are both hostages into a situation that can be changed if we are lucky enough to have leaders who are a little bit determined to find a way out.
We're going to go a lot into the sort of how does the day after look like in Gaza and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and leadership. But I do want to ask you, before everything else, you were, Samer, in Kfar Aza. You called it a condolence visit. I'm really interested to know, you know, how that went, what you saw, and the responses of you know, your fellow Palestinians to that decision to go there.
Well, this conflict unit has brought us to a level that we think both sides that everything is permissible in this conflict. I've learned something. I spent like 35 years in dialogue with Israelis. I spent 5 years in Israeli jail when I was at the age of 15 during the first Intifada. That's where I learned my Hebrew. Through communication with the guards. And then when I went out, I was elected as the International Secretary for Fatah Youth, and I started getting in touch with the Israeli labor youth, then the Likud youth, and I continued. We both have the same ethos. We both think that, or believe, that we have a just cause, and thus we both have a just fight for this cause, and then we will win. So, in a way or another, it could be right, but we should draw moral red lines in this conflict. I can't find any justification for a kid to be killed in Otev Gaza. If the Palestinian state will be achieved over the bodies of 1,200 Israelis, I don't want it. I need to find a moral way for it. Okay, I have a moral cause, but the cause does not justify the means. And I think in a way or another, most of the Israelis will not find it okay to have a kid killed every 6 minutes in Gaza, which is a tragedy. But unfortunately, both sides are wrapping these incidents into a moral content, into a moral package. And I wanted to challenge this on the Palestinian side. Regardless what is happening in Gaza, it's for the Israeli to judge at a certain time. They can still believe that it is moral, or sometimes they can have their internal debate on the morality of what's happening there. But for me, what's important for me as a Palestinian, I need to judge the incidents of the 7th of October, because what has happened there is on my shoulders. Somebody in my name have committed some acts. Okay, there could be a debate whether everything that has happened that day was done by Hamas hands, Palestinian civil hands, or other hands. Nobody knows. But I am sure there were some acts that does not represent me. I am sure that there were some kids who were kidnapped to Gaza, and this does not represent me, or women, or civilians, or other people, in addition to the killings that has happened that day. first of all, a message to my own people that in certain human issues, in crimes that are targeting civilians, we should have steadfast position. There is no margin of compromise on that. We should always say and stand against it. It's for our own self and our own interest, regardless what is the war propaganda now. Let's leave it away. We need to be in this conflict. We need to be humans before being Israelis and Palestinians. And I wanted to be there as a Palestinian and to open this debate. And maybe one day one Israeli will go to Gaza, to the city of Gaza, and open such a debate inside the Israeli society. But I don't want to make the link. I don't want to make the comparison. I want to say I'm here as a Palestinian, and what has happened on the 7th of October, regardless, everything that is happening after that day does not represent us. And we need to condemn it. And we need to be sincere into conveying this message to the Israelis, saying that we are able to feel the grief of the other side. So I opened this debate, and I think it was a very successful debate. It created a lot of backlash. There was, of course, people who issued leaflets, putting me in a category of a traitor. This is very common, but it does not mean that it needs to make us shy from such a position. I am proud of what I have done, and I think it has resulted in a debate inside the Palestinian society that is very healthy and very important for us on a moral level.
I want to say to you, Samer, that I already told you that you're one of the most brave and frank voices in the Palestinian arena, and I do respect a lot your announcements, which, you know, we could not as Israelis find such an announcement among other people in the Palestinian arena. But I do think that, you know, I really agree with you about the importance of channels of dialogue between the two peoples. But we should understand, and I think that maybe the Palestinians should understand, that October the 7th was a great shock for all the Israelis. And, you know, the basic assumptions and the basic images of the Israelis about Palestinians was dramatically undermined. You, of course, personally, and I told you, I respect a lot your ability to express a very brave voice. But most of the Israelis, they were shocked not only because the massacre, but also because the lack of criticism, the denial, the lack of empathy among most of the Palestinians. You know, I personally didn't find even one intellectual, an author, journalist, a prominent one, who could really say the things that you said. You know, that it is regardless to the war in Gaza, what happened on October the 7th was really war crimes, horrible war crimes. Because I think that without speaking frankly about those topics and without really promoting self-criticism among both peoples, I mean the Israeli and the Palestinian, I think that we will not be able really to promote any kind of coexistence. Because, and we will speak about it, I'm sure, later, most of the Israelis, they have a very, very sad conclusion from the war and from October the 7th about coexistence. And, you know, for me personally, it's sad to say this, but I'm not sure that things will continue, you know, like they were before October the 7th. And I do think that we should think about maybe creative ideas about the relations between the two communities in the future, because it's quite clear that this historic junction really changed the mutual relations between the two peoples.
Well, I agree, but I would like to say something. I'm not trying to justify anything. I'm trying to explain things for all of us to understand, and then maybe we can think together of how to find solutions. Mm-hmm. I believe, first of all, that it's wrong that Israelis think alone about a way out of the conflict with the Palestinians. And it's also wrong for the Palestinians to think alone on a way out of this conflict. We need to be able to think together, you know, have a lot of dreams, among ourselves, but then the Israelis are far away from these dreams, and we will not be able to achieve. There is a lot of frustration among Palestinians. Take me an example. I am now 52 years old. I am until now not a citizen of any state. Israel does not accept me to be a citizen in the state of Israel. And Israel still did not agree on allowing a Palestinian state where I can be a citizen. And one of the basic rights for any human being in the world is to be at least a citizen in one state. This lack of statehood, this lack of agency, if I am not able to influence the system that most powerfully decides the details of my life, if I feel that I cannot elect, I cannot be elected, nobody hears me, nobody counts me, even now in the Israeli media, when you look at the Israeli media, you don't see a minimum of what's happening in Gaza. We are not counted. Okay, the Israeli media shows the Israeli military operation, your soldiers. You tell the stories of your soldiers in Gaza, but you don't tell the Palestinian story in Gaza. And it's not only Abbas in the West Bank. There are Palestinian families who are just like the Israeli families. They would like to have a living. The frustration over the years can create a lot of ugly things, a lot of reactions. If you don't allow a person to express himself in a peaceful way, to try to influence his life in a peaceful way, this is a good environment for violence. Now, we are not justification. I'm not trying to justify. But I'm saying we need to work together into a new reality where, first of all, I should be able to revise my education system. And I would like to revise my education system parallel to a revision process on the Israeli education system. Because incitement is on both sides. Maybe it is 70% on the Palestinian side. Maybe it is 10% on the Israeli side. Maybe it's clear in my textbooks. Maybe it's clear in your classroom environment, the discussions that are happening there. But there are some incitement on both sides, and we need to eliminate this incitement. We need to revise the media. The Palestinian media always represent the bad thing of the Israelis. We show only the Israeli soldier, the settler. We show only the guns. We show only the bombings. We don't show the other side of the Israelis. And there is a lot of positive things from the Israeli people, from the Israeli culture, from the Israeli political model. There is a lot of things that I can connect to and learn from. And the same, the Israelis are showing only the bad things from the Palestinians. If we work on the education system, if we work on the media, if we start showing the good side of our opponent, I think we might be able to recreate the Israelis and the Palestinians again. Maybe we can look at the narrative also. As far as we have two narrative ideas that are fighting each other, we will not be able to solve things. We can unify the narrative.
Yeah. If only we had a representative of the Israeli media in this conversation. Yeah.
If only. Samir, both of you actually have taken us to the really sort of long-term, deep roots of how things might change. We brought you both together because we wanted to talk about the day after. And in some ways, we were thinking of that at a sort of more diplomatic level. But you've taken us rightly, I think, to this much more the sort of deeper level. But just on that, the way that the phrase day after is understood, do you think in some ways that whole idea that there will be a day after is a kind of fantasy? Because it might very well be just like the day before, in the sense that Hamas will not be fully banished and exiled from Gaza, which was in a way the assumption of the early talk of the day after. Are things in Gaza going to be quite a lot like they were before October the 7th? Or either one of you, maybe start with you, Michal. Or is it plausible, is it realistic to think that something very different is going to be there the day after?
This is, I think, maybe the most important question today, Jonathan, regarding the whole war. And, you know, I'll start with the good news. The good news is that the Israeli government started to speak about the day after. You know, there were several months, at least one or two, that this kind of discussion wasn't at all on the tables of the decision makers, the political one. And now, yeah, we can say that the political and the military decision makers in Israel started to speak about it. But we are still speaking about two prominent problems. First of all, is that many of the ideas that are elaborated during the discussion, they are not realistic enough. You know, some of them are even illusions. You know, during the whole discourse, there are ideas, and I'm sure that Samer also knows some of them, about chieftaincies of armed clans that will rule Gaza instead of any kind of political address, or to convince Hamas to evacuate Gaza like Arafat did in 1982 in Beirut, or maybe to convince the international community to deploy forces, military one, in Gaza Strip and be responsible for Gaza Strip instead of Israel. And I think that, first of all, we must be very realistic when we promote such a strategic, important discourse. The second problem is that, you know, we're speaking about the day after, but we're still in the day before. You know, when you check Gaza Strip, first of all, Hamas still, although some Hamas suffered severe damages in the military, in the political, in the civil levels, no doubt at all, but Hamas still controls a lot of geographic areas in a Gaza Strip. And you can also add to this bizarre hybrid situation the fact that in every place that the IDF left and evacuated, for example, in the northern parts of Gaza, the city of Gaza itself, for example, the neighborhoods of Rimal, Shati, Jabalia, Hamas actually returned to those places. So, you know, we always want to be very optimistic and speak about, you know, a positive future, but we still need to understand Israel didn't create the conditions to a new situation in Gaza. We are still facing a very dramatic challenge of Hamas. And without controlling all Gaza Strip, not only a part of Gaza Strip, but all Gaza Strip, and really attempt to implement this goal of eradicating the military capabilities of Hamas, I don't think that we will ever be able to speak about alternatives, or maybe the PA will return, or maybe there will be a kind of local leadership that will be developed in Gaza. So I think that the whole issue of the day after should be, let's call it like that, should be framed in a very realistic manner.
But that can take what you're describing can take months and years, no?
And years, yeah, sure. We're speaking about a voyage, you know, historic mm-hmm. voyage. This is not a matter of 2-3 weeks. I think that the Israeli public already started to understand that this is not an operation, a round of escalation. This is really a historic moment. And, you know, I even think, Yonit, that the public here in Israel is, till now, is ready to support the government. Although there are some question marks about the direction, about the targets. And, you know, in many manners, I think that the public here in Israel is much more clever and much more sharp in his understandings than the government.
But Samer, I want to continue that conversation about the day after in Gaza. Mohammed Dahlan, who's an advisor to today, the president of the United Arab Emirates, obviously a very influential Palestinian exile, says to the New York Times, essentially, the plan is to have a new Palestinian leader who can assume some kind of responsibility in Gaza, Arab states helping him out. How realistic is that as we sit here and talk 4 months into the war, that this is the reality if Hamas is not defeated in any way?
Well, we have to unlock two problems to be able to reach to the day after.
If it's only two, I think we're okay.
We're okay.
The first problem is how to convince Abbas to step aside, to retire, to go to a phase of being a honorable president, but he needs to move all his authority to a new body. This step is very important because the new government should be able to gain the trust of the people in Gaza and the trust of the people in the West Bank, should be able to gain the trust of the Israelis, and should be able to convince Hamas to deliver the keys of Gaza. This is a challenge. Who will talk to him? How can we convince him? We are into this process, and the interview of Dahlan in the New York Times was into this direction. I wrote also an op-ed in the New York Times where I said that Mahmoud Abbas must go. He is becoming the obstacle of a change of the Palestinian political system. The other problem that we need to unlock, how to convince the Israelis that they need to withdraw from Gaza while being sure that they are fulfilling their security needs. And both needs, both issues are linked to each other. Without having a Palestinian leadership that will be able to take over Gaza, that will be able to convince the international community and the Israelis that they can work with, and including some arrangements where an Arabic military force will come to Gaza, will take Gaza from Israel and deliver it to the new political body, new political Palestinian body, we will not be able to move. Israel will not withdraw from Gaza as far as they feel that there are still security threats from Gaza. So we need to find a way. And I think we can achieve this way without passing into the phase of Rafah, because Rafah can be terrible. Mm-hmm. 1.5 million refugees are there. It is a very sensitive issue with the Egyptians. The Egyptians, for them, it's a matter of national security. This is a very complicated issues. And there are solutions to Rafah. I still wonder myself, why didn't the Israelis start from Rafah? If there are tunnels who are connecting Egypt to Gaza, and these tunnels are providing whatever arms is needed to Hamas, this is the Israeli version of the challenge. Why didn't you start there? Why did you push everybody from the north to the south? And now you want to deal with the south. It's very complicated. Where can this mass of people, 1.5 million, where can they go again? So, and the issue of the security challenges in Rafah can be solved in a non-military way by negotiating with those who are managing this smuggling industry that is billions a year, billions technically. You know now, if a Gazan wants to leave Gaza, he needs to pay $20,000 just to have his name on the list that is approved to go. And it goes to a company that splits this money among different sides. And any truck that enters now to Gaza for humanitarian aid pays $8,000 to this mechanism that is controlling the borders. We need to be aware. Who are the powers that are dominating this smuggling and this trade mechanism on the borders? Then we can fix things there if we make a deal with them. It doesn't need to be approached through a military way. It's very sensitive. So are we able now as Palestinians and Arab and international community to convince the Israelis that we can provide security to them without the need to continue in the war? For us as the Palestinians, maybe for you, Mikhail, well, okay, the war can go another 1 year. It's very sad that two soldiers on an average daily fall in Gaza. But for Palestinians, it's 200 Palestinians a day. And there is a matter of urgency to stop this without underestimating the Israeli security needs. But we think we can find a diplomatic way out. Now all the stars are aligning together. The Americans, they want to solve the problem, the whole conflict, not only the Gaza war, the international community the same, and the Arabs. I have been meeting Arab officials. I have been meeting the Saudis. I was in a European capital, and I met the ambassador of Saudi Arabia there, among other Arab ambassadors. And I can see now that the Arabs now are serious. They want to get us out of this conflict. And the Saudis are serious. They want normalization with Israel. They want to provide a security package with them guaranteeing everything, with the American guaranteeing everything. The Israelis, if they take this choice, will feel secure more than ever. But we need to see how it clicks, how we can connect the dots at the same moment. For us, it's a matter of urgency. We want this now to happen. For Israelis, maybe they can wait 1 year, but we cannot wait 1 hour more because it's costing us heavy price.
Just hearing that from Sameh, Mikhail, many questions come to my mind. First, you heard from him there how the concentration of 1.5 million people in the south in Rafah means the stakes are very, very high. Is it your understanding, just because you're a close reader of these things, that Israel is going to make good on these warnings that it's giving to the world, that it's going to do a full-scale ground operation in Rafah? There are conflicting signals. I'd be interested in your read of that. But also because you are a close student of what Hamas think and do and say, you heard from Sameh that he needs not only Mahmoud Abbas out of the way, but he actually needs Hamas out the way as well for some new configuration in Gaza. Can you imagine any of the kind of international schemes that Sameh is talking about, in which it's Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Qatar or the Emirates who will govern in Gaza? What is the scenario in which Hamas say, okay, that's fine, we'll step out of the way and let you govern Gaza, rather than we're going to continue, and now we're not just going to fight Israel, we're going to fight and sabotage you, the new rulers of Gaza? So I'm putting lots in there, but I'm interested in your take.
Yeah, so I must admit, Jonathan, that I'm not very much optimistic about this kind of formula to solve the crisis right now, you know. But I really cannot see how Hamas can be convinced to leave its current position as a ruling party and maybe even to concentrate only in a civil and political level. You know, I can also say that I don't see any Israeli leader, politician that will be ready to accept this situation, that Hamas will take a part in any kind of coalition or future leadership of the Palestinian arena. You know, I think that it is quite big no from the Israeli point of view after October the 7th, because there is a very deep insight, there is a very broad conclusion among the Israelis that Hamas cannot be changed. We are speaking about even an existential threat from the Israeli point of view. So I really don't think that you can find not a Mahmoud Abbas, even not the Saudis and the Egyptians, that can come to Ismail Haniya or Yihiel Sinwar and tell them, listen, let's stop with jihad. Let's start promoting our own society. Let's start investing in hospitals and schools and leave the whole idea of jihad. I do think, you know, that you cannot really speak about any solution in Gaza without dismantling Hamas. And dismantling Hamas cannot be promoted by an agreement. It will be, unfortunately, only by military means. And, you know, Sameh mentioned a very important point, and this is the issue of Rafah. From the Israeli point of view, you cannot really create any new situation in Gaza Strip and speak about the day after without changing the basic situation in the whole corridor, in the whole border area between Keren Shalom and the shore of Rafah. Because this is the gate, the basic gate of Gaza to the world, and the basic channel that assisted Hamas to become a quasi-military force. And I'm quite sure that Israel is very much determined to promote a change in this area. But I do agree that it is much, much more complicated comparing it to other places in Gaza, for example, in Gaza City itself or even Khan Yunis, mainly because of the relations with Egypt. Israel considered them these strategic relations as a very important achievement from the Israeli point of view. I really hope that any kind of move that will be promoted in this area, in Rafah area, and of course in the border crossing of Rafah, will be done by coordination, a very deep one, between the Egyptians, which basically do not really like Hamas. They do want to see dramatic change in Gaza Strip and the Palestinian arena, but it doesn't necessarily need to be led by Hamas. And of course, with the American administration, I do think that we should not here in Israel hope or believe that there will be Arab or international force that will be deployed here. First of all, I don't think that there will be any state outside, except Israel, that will have any aspiration to be in Gaza. And second, you know, in Israel, we don't have a very good experience with international forces. So I'm quite sure that we should really return to the local basic game of Israel and the Palestinians. And here I really agree with Samer. The basic question is the mutual relations between Israel and the Palestinians. All the rest, the Saudis and Emirates and Egyptians and Jordanians and the US, they are very important. But finally, in the end of the day, all these situations should be created by those two players.
By the way, I'm really curious about one thing. We're not seeing the West Bank burning up at all during these. I mean, little incidents, but not something that you would expect. I mean, Hamas would obviously want something much larger in scale. Is that because of Palestinian security apparatus, because of the Shin Bet, because the general reticence of the population? How do you read that?
First of all, the weather is there. Mm-hmm. When will the storm come? Nobody can predict. Don't believe anybody who claims to be an expert of when war will break in the Middle East and when peace will be achieved in the Middle East. Nobody can predict both. Mm-hmm. I can tell you something, Yunit. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous if this war continues until Ramadan. Very dangerous. In Ramadan, it will be a totally different story. Now, why there is no reaction in the West Bank to what's happening in Gaza, I really don't know. But I've learned something, that in the last 15 years, all, let me call it the resistance body, is a body without head. Nobody controls it. Nobody plans for it. It just happens. And you don't know the form. Have you ever, Yunit, expected something like the 7th of October from Gaza, where everybody thought that Israel is containing Hamas and that, you know, both are in honeymoon? And then the 7th of October came out of nowhere, 7th of October can happen 10 times a day in the West Bank. What is separating any settlement, what is separating Psagot from Albir or Beit Il from Ramallah is a fence of 1.5 meters. Small 7th of October technically can happen anytime, several times a day in the West Bank. Why it's not happening, I have no answer. Will it happen or not? Nobody can know. But we are risking. By keeping this atmosphere, this weather, we are risking the storm anytime, and it could be a very hard storm. I'm really worried about Ramadan. I'm really very worried when all Muslim, not only, this war could move from Gaza into the whole region. Muslims, they go in masses to pray in Ramadan. It's very intensive. Suddenly they click to things that they did not click to in normal days. And we have seen that always Ramadan is a month for escalation. I really pray that we can find a way out of this war before Ramadan. If not, we are risking things that it will be just terrible.
I just want to say that, first of all, I really agree with the description of Samer about not only the current situation in the West Bank, but also the potential of of a future explosion. And I assess that at least among the security organizations in Israel, there is an understanding about Ramadan and the need to improve the economic situation in the West Bank, not only before Ramadan, but also in the coming months. And I personally think that the whole relatively calm situation in the West Bank caused a lot of disappointment to Yihiye Sinwar. Yihiye Sinwar really believed that he could inflame the arenas of the West Bank, the Arab sector here in Israel, of course, Lebanon, and he was very much disappointed. I do assess that the current situation in the West Bank is in somehow a result of a mixture between the basic deterrence of many Palestinians that show that they see all the views from Gaza. They do not want that Ramallah and Bethlehem and Nablus will look like Shati and Khan Yunis and Jabalia. And we can also add to this the policy or the attitude of the PA. They themselves, they keep the coordination between Israel and the and the PA, and they do not want any kind of a broad and escalation third intifada. By the way, we mentioned before the Israeli-Arab sector, and you know it's a very important point, because this is also a source of disappointment for Yihiye Sinwar. He thought that the events of May 21, the Operation Guard of the Walls, that took place in this time, and there was a broad escalation among the Arabs here in Israel, that this kind of model will repeat itself. But you know, he didn't think about two things. First of all, 24 Israeli Arab citizens were killed on October the 7th. You know, they were murdered by Hamas, and this really caused a shock for many people among the Israeli Arab sector. And second, I think that many of the Arabs here in Israel, they really fear from the respond of the government after October the 7th. And they are really worried about the relations between Jews and Arabs here in Israel. You know, there is deep alienation between the two communities. It seems that things are quite calm and there was no explosion, but you know, it's very tricky. I do think that under the ground, there is a lot of anger. And I think that the government should really pay attention to this point. It could be very explosive.
I could listen to both of you talking about this for a long, long time. Time, though, is limited for us. And so, quite briefly, I just thought I would ask a last question to both of you, because you've both talked, actually, I think you've both mentioned at some point the next generation and obviously how important that is. On one level, there are people saying that just the two generations that have seen this and witnessed this will grow up with tremendous sort of bitterness in their hearts. There is thousands of orphans in Gaza. There are the bereaved in Israel. And I think you mentioned, Samir, that desire for revenge is very strong in both. Do you see any evidence, either of you, or both of you, ideally, that next generation is thinking about this conflict in a different way from the previous generations, and that there are perhaps some grounds there to imagine a different future? What do you both see? Why don't we start with you, Samir?
Well, I find difficulties to try to explain things to my kids. And my kids, they live in Jerusalem. They go to international schools. They travel a lot. So they are not, you know, part of the society that is really having the burden of the complicity of the situation. But I cannot convince them now that there is hope for peace. I can tell you something, comparing myself to my kids. When I was 15 years old, symbols were very important for me. I was ready to lose my life, receive a bullet in my head to put the poster of Yasser Arafat in Salah al-Din Street. And this is the most important thing for me. The flag, the picture of the leader, this is how I see my identity. For Gen Z, and the expert is Michael, who wrote a very impressive study about this black hole that it took me a lot of time to understand it. For them, yes, they want national aspiration, but they don't care about symbols. For them, they want to change the reality because they want to go and surf in Gaza or in Tel Aviv like your kids surf. They want to be able to have access to the startup nation and, you know, have a salary of 20,000 shekel the first day they graduate from university. They want a passport that allows them to book last minute a cheap flight and travel to Prague. They want this style of life. They have a lot of common things among themselves. I'll tell you a small story. 3 years ago, the latest Spider-Man movie was released. And my daughters, two of my daughters, forced me to take them to Cinematheque in Jerusalem. I went there. We were the only Palestinians, a crowd of young Israelis. I discovered two things. I don't know why, that all this generation speaks English more than their mother language. Maybe because it was an American movie and they were, you know, discussing things. And then suddenly I was there and I can see that these kids jump and shout after some scenes. I did not understand the reason. They understood it, that there were scenes from previous Spider-Man and they were happy to see the. So I saw how much they have in common, yet how much the situation is separating them. So I am, in these days, I think it's a challenge, but on the long term, I am optimistic. These young generations can connect to each other. We need to provide for them the right tools and environment.
Well, I agree with Summer that Gen Z, it's really a big headache. I got some of them here in my home. You know, they got many, many good things, but there are many challenges. Mainly, I would call it a very shallow opinions and, you know, a very, very limited way to understand the world. And I think that when we check the young generation in both communities, and we are still in the level of trauma, we are not in the PTSD, you know, in the post-trauma level. I think that first of all, and it regards to both communities, not only the Gen Z or the young generation. First of all, we must think about not being too much close to each other. I do think that in the next levels, we should think about dialogues. But first of all, we should think about separation, physical one. And I think that this is the main target that both communities should think about. If we focus on the young generation here in Israel, the Israelis, the Jewish community, I do think that one of the lessons that are most important for many Israelis after October the 7th is that you need to be more curious about your neighbors. You need to understand them. And in order to understand them, I mean the Arab society and the Middle East, you need to learn their language. You know, less and less Jews here in Israel know Arabic, really understand the basic codes of the Islamic society. And I it's not only a feeling, it's based on facts that more and more civilians, Jews here in Israel, they do want now to learn Arabic. And I'm quite sure that after this traumatic conflict, I do think that the government here in Israel should promote a role that will actually enforce pupils in schools, mainly in the Hebrew education system, to learn Arabic, the spoken one. I think that after this separation and after really learning deeply each other, and I do think, Summer, that the same thing should be done also in the Palestinian arena. I mean, really to learn about the Jews, and you not only from all kind of Hamas channels, but really to learn about the other community without the negative images. Maybe after that, and it will take time, several years at least, we could start speaking about dialogue, people to people. I'm trying not to mix wishful thinking and assessments, but if the first stages will be promoted and will be implemented, maybe we can speak about coexistence and dialogue within several years.
I'm holding on to the idea of Spider-Man for world peace that Samuel brought us to in this conversation. Samuel Zanijlawi and Michael Mishten, it was a pleasure to talk to you both. Please come on again. And we really thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Yonit and Jonathan.
Thank you both. Thank you. Well, I said at the, towards the end of our conversation there that I really could listen to them for hours, and I genuinely meant it. It's partly because listening is really what you and I were doing there. We were eavesdropping on an encounter between the two of them, not the first, as we've said, but just the rarity of it is what came through to me. I realized that through this war, we have very rarely heard what we just heard there, which is a committed Israeli who's actually been involved in the, you know, defense of his country, and a committed Palestinian who is part of the organized Palestine National Movement. These are not fringe people talking to each other in an amicable way, in a very friendly way, but very honest and very open, talking about how they see this. And that dialogue is just become, as I said, vanishingly rare in recent months. It wasn't sort of kumbaya and just sort of sweet nothings. It was really substantial, very meaningful. They weren't saying things that would necessarily, you know, please the other or, you know, wishful thinking. Some hard truths spoken there, but I thought it was gripping.
I mean, two incredibly impressive individuals. And I was thinking as they were talking, I mean, it's 30 years since the Oslo Accords were signed. And I remember these conversations much more, these public kind of conversations being a much more, you know, prominent thing 30 years ago. Today, you rarely, of course, after October 7th, you don't hear these kinds of conversations. And I'm really glad that we had it on Unholy, that they could talk. And as you said, there were some uncomfortable truths there from both sides, but no bickering. I mean, and we really kind of just could have let that conversation happen. If anything, I think we probably bothered them. but I'm really glad that we had them both on together.
And in a way, it's exactly what Unholy is for. And I do ask myself, in a way, where else might people have heard a conversation like that? And we say we'd want them back on again. I think we want more conversations like that here. So we are grateful to Samer and Michael for that. To our weekly awards, then. For this week's Chutzpah Award, I think this may be a returning nominee, namely the man who I'm rather proud to have dubbed the Miami Dauphin, Yair Netanyahu, son of Benjamin. Long-time listeners will remember that he appeared in this category when he was sitting out the war, age 32, very much eligible for reserve duty. Nevertheless, sitting out the war in Miami, Florida, and that was noted in the early weeks of the war. Then, perhaps slightly shamefacedly, he did make a show of returning and doing a little bit of light volunteer efforts in Israel. Well, guess what? He is very much back in the sunshine in Miami, Florida, hunkering down, according to the Daily Mail Online, in $5,000 a month Florida high-rise, where he is protected round the clock by Israeli Shin Bet bodyguards, and kind of, in the words of the Daily Mail, loafing around in shorts and sweatshirts permanently, you know, sipping drinks, entertaining pals, at one point showing them a VR headset. I think the point about this is not just that he is sort of living the, you know, indulgent life, but it's that he sounds off all the time on social media in this very bellicose, hardcore way, but meaning this is a really important war for somebody else to fight. Meanwhile, I'm going to just, you know, bask in the sunshine. The chutzpah is that he had already done it once, pretended to have returned to Israel, and basically has gone back to doing it. I think it's a double chutzpah for that reason. So Yair Netanyahu, Miami Dauphin, sunning himself in Miami, Florida, while his countrymen fight a very difficult war in Gaza, our chutzpah of the week.
I'll add just two things. One is that Yair Netanyahu himself was helpful in promulgating a conspiracy theory about betrayal inside the Israeli Air Force. These stories, by the way, were running around after October 7th because of the shock of the failure of the intelligence and the failure on the operational scale. So there have been these conspiracy theories about a traitor from within in the Israeli Defense Forces that allowed for this whole massacre to happen. Yair Netanyahu, as I said, participated at least in part of that. And the other thing I would say is go to our episode 108 called Netanyahu the Second. There we talk with the Haaretz journalist Chaim Levinson about the influence of Yair Netanyahu on his father. Shall we move on to greener pastures in our mensch category?
Yes.
Good.
Let's do
it. So, by the way, have you noticed that since the war, I do the mensch more than you do? It's a reversal of roles here, just saying.
You know what I have noticed? What I've noticed is that you haven't mentioned that you always do the chutzpah. And so, because I know you'd be very quick on that. And therefore, the fact that you haven't been berating me for hogging the mensch category tells me that you have been...
That I have been
inroads.
Hogging the mensch category.
Yeah, that's the way I know. Otherwise, you know? I'm not, as listeners may suspect, I'm not keeping count. But the fact that you haven't been mentioning it tells me no mention means mensch. So tell us who this week's mensch is.
I think this week we will officially give it to Raymond Simonson, the CEO of JW3. JW3 is the Jewish Arts, Culture, and Community Center in London. And our one of our favorite listeners, I think it's okay to say. So he is receiving the mensch award this week due to a project called the Lovelock Hostages Bridge, in which they actually filled locks of all shapes and sizes with messages of support and love for the hostages as a way to raise the awareness to this, to the plight of the hostages. A really beautiful, these really beautiful scenes in which people sign with the name of the hostages and then put on this sort of padlock on the bridge itself. And now many of those. I think these are really beautiful pictures. They're on social media, and I think it's a beautiful project.
Yeah, very much so. And Raymond Simonson, longtime friend of the podcast, very glad to make you our mensch of the week for, you know, channeling that beautiful idea that comes originally out of one of the bridges in Paris, where people, lovers, would padlock. I think eventually they had to remove so many of them. They were worried the bridge was going to be weighed down in Paris. Well, it's early days yet for JW3 and a brilliant gesture. If you are glad that we have made Raymond our mensch and Yair Netanyahu our chutzpah of the week, you know where to express your approval by reviewing and rating the podcast. Lots of you do that. It really does help drive visibility for Unholy on the various podcast platforms. So do keep doing that. We're there on Facebook and on Instagram at Unholy Podcast. And we are always glad to hear from you.
We are, and we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primat, Omri Barak, and we shall meet next week.
Yeah, see you then, Yonit.
See you.